Good morning, then. And today we have two tasks ahead. The first one is finish the introduction to the structured proof language ESA. And the second one is to start with simple algorithms, simple functional algorithms, and their analysis, including analysis of running times. So, what do I have to still teach you about ESA? Well, first a few closing remarks on the last session, and then this induction is the main thing on the menu for today. And I think this is, this is better. So, first, what to do when automation fails? And the simple answer in ESA as well is split your proofs up into smaller steps. If you can't do it in one big step, you need smaller steps. But how to find out what is a good intermediate step in a larger proof? That you can do with apply. So assume you have some intermediate steps that you want to prove, and none of the automatic tactics can prove it, then you can start exploring the situation with apply. And this is, assume it's like that, you want to prove something, and you've already said, I want to use these facts that I already have. And what you then do, first you do something that looks a bit strange, apply minus, that's just a bookkeeping thing. It says everything that comes into this proof step, so in particular, everything I've mentioned here in using should now become part of the proof state. Otherwise, it's just floating around as something that you can use, but it's not, strictly speaking, part of the proof state, part of the assumption list. And this apply minus makes it part of the assumption list. And now you can continue with your usual apply scripts. And you can, for example, now do apply auto. That's a good first step. And then it will probably show you the different subgoals that it can't prove that are left over from the one subgoal that you wanted to prove. And then you maybe you realize, I should first prove these three things, and then this follows automatically with auto. So that's one way of doing it. In the worst case, you just keep hacking away at that. That's not really recommended, but it's typically what you start to do. And at the end, ideally, you convert this unstructured sequence of applies back into a little piece of structured text that you probably, some of it will have to go before this half, because you first have to prove some intermediate, more intermediate facts before you can do this. Of course, you can also be lazy and you just write done after this list of applies and hope that we won't deduct any points for such terrible proofs. And better it is to convert this possibly ugly script into a structured proof. So this is a hint on how to go about when you try to prove something and the automation fails, and how to find out what the auxiliary facts are that you may need. Then there is one more thing that I should mention, namely local lemmas. If you want to prove in the middle of a proof a little lemma, and that little lemma has its own premises and has its own universally quantified variables, then this is the way you can do it. Have B is the thing you really want to prove, but you want to prove it under some assumptions that are just local in that subproof of this lemma here, and you want to prove it for all values x1 to xn. And that's how you can do it. So this is the syntax for it. It's a different syntax for this. We have this fixes, assumes, shows for lemma statements, and this is the same thing but for a local lemma in the middle of a proof where you have a half step. These assumptions can also be named. You give a name and then you list the assumptions for that particular fact B that you're trying to prove. And what it proves in the end is when you've successfully, so afterwards, of course, you have to give a proof for that half, and if the proof succeeds, this is what you get out. You get out the implication that all of the AI together imply the B. Now, with one more thing, what happens to the X's? The X's have now been replaced by these unknowns question mark X. So that means you have now obtained locally a lemma that will work for arbitrary values of the XIs, which get instantiated by unification as necessary when you use that little lemma. So this is just a generalization of the normal half if you want to locally add assumptions and locally say, oh, this should be true for all X's. And finally, ProofSafe and ESAR text, how do they correspond? If you look in the buffer, there's also there's the output buffer and the state buffer, and in particular in the state buffer, or also part of the output buffer, you see the proof state, and how is that in correspondence to what you write? So in general, when you start a proof, you say proof, and then you say some proof method. Maybe you just say minus, in that case nothing much happens, but if you say proof, for example, and then induction, then this proof method will generate some subgoals, and these subgoals are visible in the proof state. And so the proof state that is the result of this method will have a number of subgoals of this general form, and that means if you get n new subgoals, n new subgoals, then you will have to prove inside that proof block here, you will have to prove n statements, one for each of these subgoals that were generated. So for an induction of a natural numbers, it will be two subgoals that you have to prove. And how to prove each subgoal? Well, at least I can give you the outline of what you should be proving. If you look at this text here, you can see what you have to prove, namely, you have to fix these variables, x1 up to xn, you have to assume the things on the left, and then you have to show the thing on the right. That's the correspondence between what the system shows you as a subgoal and what you have to write down as an ESAR text. Now, this isn't strictly true because some of the XI may have already been fixed in some outer block. And so you only have to fix those that are new to this block that were generated by this proof method. Similarly for the assumptions just keep accumulating, so you only need to assume those things that are new in this proof step. But you do need, for every subgoal with a B at the end, you need to have one show for that B. So that's the, if you want to check whether your idea of what you should be proving is the same as the system's idea what you should be proving, you go and look at the proof state, and then you see, oh yes, there are these two subgoals, so I need to write at least two shows of these two subgoals, and I need to assume some stuff, and I need to fix some variables if necessary. And, yeah, since there may be multiple blocks of this form here, they need to be separated, and there's the keyword next that tells you now we're moving on to the next of the subgoals. Although they don't have to be ordered in the same order as the subgoals, they can be any order. Right, and those were the things that... sort of some of the nitty-gritty details that I haven't yet told you about, and now we move on to more conceptual things, namely how to do proof by cases and proof by induction in the ESAR language. So, yeah. And we start, the best thing to do is to start with an example, and we do proof by cases, and we had already seen two kinds of proof by cases. One was where in one case you assume P and the other you assume not P. And we had also seen a proof by cases where starting from an OR, a formula where you have proved formula 1 or formula 2, you could then make a case distinction on that. This is now a proof by cases on a data type. Oops, that wasn't it. Okay. It's one of these. Yes. So here is the text. So we're trying to prove that the length of the tail of a list is the same as the length of the list minus one. And one way of proving this is you do a case distinction on the form of X. And that's what this line here says. Proof, and the proof method is cases X. And so what this means is the system will look at X's and say, oh, X's is a list. Not again.
Last time I got to take X quickly, I'm not sure this will work again.
Doing that almost every second lecture now. It's coming back. Okay, so let's continue where we got interrupted by the projector. So we do a proof by cases over X's, and the system will look at X's and determine, oh, X's is a list, and therefore cases over a list means you explore the different constructors that the list variable could have at the outer level. So in case of lists, the X's can either be an empty list or it can be a cons of something. And so these are exactly the two cases that you can then write down. So in the first one you write down, you assume that X is empty. And thus these is by simp, well, of course, that's clear. If X is the empty list, the tail of the empty list is again empty. And so you have length of the empty list, which is zero on the left, and you have length of the empty list, which is again zero on the right, and minus one of zero is again zero. So it is a true fact. And what do we have in the second case? Here we have to say, okay, we now assume that X is of the form Y cons Ys for some fixed Y and Ys. And if you remember what I told you about the correspondence between the proof state and what you see in the output window, if you go to the output window, here you see the two proof states that correspond to what I've written there in ESA. One is where the first line is X is empty, and then you have to prove something. And then the second line, X is a cons list. So the system has chosen the names A and list for the two variables that are the components of the cons. We have chosen a different variable naming Y and Ys, but again, we assume that X is of this form, and also thesis is by simp. So the important point here is not the individual proof, but it's the structure, the skeleton of this proof. If you do cases on some data type term, it doesn't have to be a variable, it can be an arbitrary term, then you have to go through all the possible constructors and get in each case say, okay, let's assume the term that we're doing the case distinction on is of the form of this constructor applied to some variables, and the variables here are then locally fixed with, like here, fix y and y's. Of course, for the empty list, there was nothing to fix because the empty list doesn't have any arguments. But in general, the constructors will have arguments. So this is the explicit way of doing it, where you really explicitly write down what you assume. You don't have to write down what you need to show. Remember, we have this thesis abbreviation, and thesis just refers to the thing that you're currently trying to prove, and the thing you're currently trying to prove is still that same statement that you started to prove, so that hasn't changed. If you do a case distinction, it doesn't mean that you suddenly prove something else. It just means you have additional assumptions, namely that some object is of a certain form. And if you look at the result of the proof by cases here, the proof step, then you also see in the sub-goal here and here, the statement that you have to prove is still the same. You have just gained additional assumptions. And therefore, we could just reuse thesis and didn't have to write down that long statement once again. Now, but we did have to write down this line here and this line here, which in some sense can be generated by the system automatically because the system knows we're talking about lists, and so it knows exactly there are these two cases, and if you look at the proof state, it does generate them. So can we maybe also mimic this in ESA? And yes, we can. So this is, let's get rid of this. This is the an unreadable version of it, because let me just throw out everything that we don't want to see for them now. This is the implicit version of the same proof. And here, so the format is different. Here you can compare the two proofs. They both start with proof cases, X's. And in the first one, you explicitly write down what you assume and what you fix. In the second one, you write case, and then you say, I'm now going into the case nil. So I'm giving the name of the constructor that we're going into. And that implicitly means, please assume that the thing that we're doing the case distinction on, the X's, is of the form empty list. And similarly, in the second one, where we say case cons y y's, that's just a more compact way of writing the longer line up there, fix y y's, assume x's is y cons y's. So down here is an abbreviation of what you have in the first proof, and you don't need to explicitly say that object X's is of that particular form. You have said that by just saying case cons y y's. Yeah.
So my question is, if you have multiple cases in the upper one?
Pardon? If you have?
In the first one?
Yeah. If you have what there?
Multiple assumptions.
There is only one assumption in a case distinction. Because we are doing a case distinction on some object, and there's always the assumption that object is of this form or that form or the other form.
Okay. So basically the case is extracted from the assumption.
The case is... So, I didn't understand it. The case...
So the case is equivalent, right? So
yes.
The case syntax is equivalent.
This is exactly equivalent to this one. No, the other way around. This is the basic syntax, and this is the abbreviating syntax.
Right.
So. And this case syntax, the case nil and the case cons, is only possible because you've written these cases. Whereas assume you can always write. You can always write, assume something. It's just at some point the system will complain that you've assumed something that you weren't allowed to assume. But case syntax, this case is only, it becomes, if you, for example, if you write up here, just prove minus, don't do anything. That's perfectly okay. The proof step goes through, but then it'll later on, the proof will fail because why would you can you possibly assume that the list is empty? Whereas down there in the implicit form, if you here do proof minus, then it'll say case nil. It says what case, I've never seen the case, where does that case nil come from? Because you haven't told it to do a proof by cases. So always think of the case syntax as an abbreviation for this longer syntax. And for case distinction, it doesn't pay off very much yet. For inductions, the same mechanism works, and there it really pays off to do it like that, to do it in the abbreviated form. But in principle, it's perfectly fine to write the long form. There's nothing wrong with that. So, okay, I think that's it. Yeah.
If we use the implicit form, how do we refer to the assumption?
Ah, good question. That brings me back to something that I deleted. So here, after the case thing, this example is too simplistic because we don't refer to the assumptions explicitly. We just use in the upper proof we say thus, meaning the assumption is piped into the statement. But in general, you may want to refer to them indeed. And the list of the assumptions that you get, in this case only just one assumption, is has a name, and the name is just the name of that constructor. And so if you underneath the in the second proof, if you ask the system, please, what is the theorem called nil? And if you look in the output buffer, the theorem nil is exactly the assumption that X is nil. And if you ask, what is the theorem called, down here, called cons, it's that assumption that X is Y wise. Oh, and something else, you don't, strictly speaking, need to give the names of Y and Y's at this point. You could just say, this is the case cons, and I don't care what you call my variables, because you're not referring to them in the subsequent proof. But in general, you may refer to them, and therefore it's better to also give the arguments names. And one last little caveat, you really need to use the symbolic, the alphanumeric name of the constructors here, nil and here cons. You can't write this syntactic sugar with the open and closed square brackets. It really needs to have the alphanumeric names there. That's just a little limitation. Further questions? Then there's something else I should say, which I also forgot. If you do proof cases X's in both of the proofs, because it's, you see that there is some information on the right, on the left, sorry. And if you click on the proof, then it actually says, oh, by the way, here's a proof outline. So you don't have to write all of that by hand. You can click on the proof outline, and it'll transport it into your proof window. And of course, it can't do the actual proof, but it can do the skeleton, and it gives it the names that you saw in the output window. So it's called A and list, but you could now change the names. So this is quite helpful, especially for beginners who still have problems with that syntax, to just click on the outline. Then you at least get a correct skeleton that you then have to fill in with the individual proof steps. So this is, in case all of this flashing confused you, let me just show it to you once again. This is typically how you would start, and then you say, oh, there's something displayed here under the proof, and then I get the outline, and then I can paste the outline in, and now I have the lemma with a skeleton, which I can now continue to refine. Okay. So much about
Is there a difference between thesis and cases? We use it after show?
Yes, there is. you saw the case in the exercises. Yes, and this is for induction, and we'll get to that in a moment. Yeah. So here it's thesis, because what you're proving is still the same thing. Later on in an induction, in the different induction cases, you're not proving the same thing. You're substituting zero for it, for example, or you're substituting successor for it, and therefore this other syntax is, or this other name case is used. Yeah. No. I think if you write case now, it'll just say what's case. Yes, unbound schematic variable case. Yeah. Okay, then let's move back to the slides. So let me just summarize what we saw.
You have a data type in general, which has any number of constructors, C1 up to whatever. And then if you say, I want to do a proof by cases on some terms, so it doesn't have to be a variable. And then, in fact, the system will generate for you a skeleton that looks like this, where for each of the constructors in your data type, so assuming that this term T is of the type, that the term here is of type T, then the case, each case will be one of the constructors in the declaration of T. And it'll put in some variable names that it has chosen. You can put in arbitrary variable names, and then you can refer to those variable names in the proof itself. So this is the general format. And this blue bit is just an abbreviation for fixing all the variables, all the argument variables of the constructor, and assuming that your term up here is equal to the form constructor applied to all these variables. And in addition, this assumption here is given a name, and the name is chosen by the system, and it's just the name of the constructor. Yep.
Can this lead to like naming clashes, or is it?
Yes. So if you do two case distinctions, one after the other, then you will get two assumptions with the same name. If both of them are on the same data type list, you'll have an outer nil and an inner nil. Nil is maybe not a good idea, but yeah. So you, in that sense, it can be name clashes, but maybe that's not what you meant.
Yeah, or something like that. What does the system do? Does it just say name clash, or does it shadow? Or?
It shadows, and then you have to give an explicit name to the thing up here. And the way to do that, if you have used the implicit syntax, the syntax here, is you would then write, say, case whatever cons and x x's, and then you say note, and now you call it, I don't know, outer equals cons. So you introduce a new name, outer, because you're going to have another one, inner, and then you say, oh, this is equivalent to cons, and now if you shadow cons later on, you can still refer to outer. So this is something that occasionally is necessary, in case you have these nested case distinctions of the same constructor, of the same data type. Right, now the same thing for induction. It's almost the same mechanism, except, as I just said, the difference in an induction is that you don't just have different assumptions in each case, you also have a different thing to prove in each case. And so now let's look at a very simple example, structure induction on natural numbers. And this is the first explicit version. So here we're summing, and so the capital sigma, the summation operator, takes as an argument a set, and here we've written the set with the dot notation, so it's an interval between 0 and n, and you're summing over the interval between 0 and n, and then, of course, the Gauss formula tells us that's the same as n times n plus 1 diff 2, and this is what we want to prove. And in order not to have to duplicate things too much, I introduce this is
PN. So P, the proposition P, now stands for that whole formula, but not just P, but P of N. So we can actually vary that proposition by putting in something other than N. And that's exactly what we're doing now. We say, okay, proof by induction on N. And in fact, if we look at it, we also get a proof outline, which we could use, but I want to use a different outline, so I've written it by hand. So now, in the base case, you say, show P of 0. So that means you're taking the lemma statement, and you're not using N, but you're using 0 instead of N in that statement, so we're showing the 0 case. And in the induction step, you fix some n, you assume that p of n holds, and then you have to show p of suck of n. So this is really a blueprint for how to do induction on natural numbers, using the abbreviation mechanism with this pattern matching is, and introducing your the propositional variable p. And otherwise, this is really like you see it in a textbook, except that in a textbook you wouldn't write success of n, you would write n plus 1. But this being Isabel, the natural numbers are defined over successor. And the individual proof steps are irrelevant here, so I'm not going into them. It happens to work automatically. Here is, if you really want to see it, here's a second version where you have explicitly written out the transformations in the proof step, in the induction step, how to get from the sum over 0 to successor of n to p of successor of n. But I don't want to go through those details. So the question is, does the thing that you've seen here, does that make sense, or is that anything unclear about this one? Yes?
And now you could use, instead of P sub n, you could use case.
We will now, indeed, you could use case. Yeah. And we will see that in the, so this is the explicit version, and now we will see the implicit version where we make use of the system-generated names. And let me just get rid of some of these statements because they're not necessary. So this is the, let me again remove the bit in the middle, and then we can see both proofs side by side. Let me also remove this. Yep. Now we see both proofs, not side by side, one above the other. So the explicit version comes first, and then comes the implicit version, and it looks like the case distinction, but the proof method is induction, and you have two cases, case 0, so 0 is really a legal name, but then case suck of n, and now you don't say show thesis, but you show case. You show what you have to prove in that case. So don't get confused about the this case here, which is the keyword, which in the proof language, and this case, which is just a name that the system introduced for the statement that has to be proved in that case. And if you look at it, and if you ask the system, please, what does question mark case stand for? It'll say, oh, question mark case stands for this big formula where n has been replaced by 0. So you can ask it, if you just look at the output window and you go behind the showcase, and then it shows you down there at the bottom what question mark case stood for, namely the sum from zero to zero is 0 times 0 plus 1 div 2. So it's just the specialization of your proposition where n has become 0. And if you ask the same question, if you go thus case in the line below, then you see again this is your sub-goal, so it's where you have replaced n by successor of n. But you don't need to do all this, introduce a p and say p of 0 and p of successor. You just say case, and it'll generate for you the right formula, or rather question mark case stands for the right formula. And you can actually, you don't need to, you can separately use the command term term says, please print out the following term, and the term I want to see is case. What is case? And then at the bottom it shows you case stands for this formula. Just like theorem prints out the theorem term, prints out the term, gives you its type. So there are these two ways of writing the inductions, and a priori there's no clear winner. I'll make a small comment on different proof styles in a moment, but both of these are quite acceptable. The second one is the more frequently used one because you have to type a little bit less, but otherwise the difference isn't big. Then let's go back and look at this on the slide.
So this is the implicit way of doing it, structure induction for natural numbers. You want to show some proposition P with an N in it. You say induction on N. Then you have case zero. You have to show case, which will be the formula P where the N has become zero. Here you have a case suck of N. Show question mark case. And then the system will, for question mark case, put in this P where N has become suck of N. And again, yes, I didn't show that. If you want to refer to the assumption from this case or from this case, they carry the same name as the constructor. So this assumption will be called suck, and this assumption will be called zero. And this becomes clear when you... the system doesn't show you this, but I'm showing you. This statement, case zero, is just a shorthand for the statement, let question mark case be the statement P of zero. And so this is where the question mark case is defined implicitly by this, and then you can use it there. So what does this stand for? This case here stands both for a definition of case and for an assumption, namely the assumption that the induction hypothesis is true. So we have first the assumption that the induction hypothesis is true for some n, so you fix an n, and you assume that P of n is true, and you call this assumption suck, just like the case here, and then you also define this abbreviation question mark case, and this stands for your proposition P up there with a successor instead of an n. Yeah?
What's the difference between the let and the note?
A let is for terms, note is for theorems. Okay, then let's look at a more complicated variant. This was simple in that I implicitly assumed that this P is atomic in the sense that there aren't any framework implications, any of these double arrows in there. If the P itself is an implication with a double arrow, then things are slightly more complicated, and we will see that in the first, in the system, and then on the slides. So this is a concrete example. This is what we want to prove. If an element is in a list, it's in the set of elements of a list, so set was this function that converts a list into a set, then there must exist two lists, y's and z's, such that x is of the form first the prefix y's, then the element x, and then a suffix z's. That's fairly intuitive. And now what happens, I don't want to go into the details of the proof, but again, the skeleton is the important thing. Let's ignore the base case. It's not very interesting, but let's look at the induction step. And so we're doing an induction on x's, and here we have the cons AX's case here. And so the question is, what do we think that we have to prove at this point, and what do we think we can assume? Normally, you would say, oh, well, you have to prove, you can assume, say, exactly this implication, and you have to prove this implication, but now with the X being... You assume that implication, and you have to prove that implication, but where the axis has now become cons A axis. That's logically correct, but the system does a little bit more, because when you're now in the situation where your induction hypothesis is some implication, in this case, x element axis implies something or other, and your goal would be x element, set of axis, set axis, and here it would be set of A axis, and then some implies. So this is the goal, logically speaking, and then the system says, well, if it's a goal that has itself an assumption, why don't we move this assumption already into the global assumption list and focus right away on what we have to prove? And so this is why it becomes a bit more complicated if you have implicational statements, because then a little bit more happens under the hood, and you get a longer list of assumptions, namely not just the induction hypothesis, but also all the premises of your implicational statement. And in the end, the thing you have to prove, the question mark case, will just be the whatever it is here, and that will be our question mark case. And this will be another assumption, and this will be called, in fact, that will be given a sensible name, as you can see up there, under the theorem statements. This one will really be called cons.ih, and this will be called cons.prems. To distinguish what is the induction hypothesis amongst your assumptions and what is the thing that you just get because you're proving an implicational statement and you're already assuming the left-hand sides of the implication. And if you go to the output panel and you say theorem cons.ih, then you see this is exactly the induction hypothesis. This is precisely what we have to prove in the lemma statement. And if you ask what is cons prems, then it's the left side of the implication that we're trying to prove, namely that that x is an element of A cons axis. And if you can also ask now what is term question mark case, and then it'll say, oh, it's this existential statement, so it's the, if you go back to what we're trying to prove, it's just the very end of the implication. That is what the question mark case is. And the other thing, this part has already been given a name and is something you can assume, namely here, cons.prems. And if you just ask, what is cons? So there's this convention that if you say case and then some constructor, it'll always, all the assumptions of that case will have the name of that case. And if there are multiple assumptions, then it'll just be a list of things. So here it's the first thing in the list is the induction hypothesis, and the second thing in the list is the left-hand side of the implication you're trying to prove. And so this is really as far as I want to take it. The actual proof is not of interest here. And so if you go to the thus case line, you can also see this is what you have to prove. The sub-goal is this existential statement. So the question is does the mechanism make sense, or is that... and this naming convention with the dot IH and the dot prems, that's helpful, so you don't have to refer to the long list cons and maybe write something like cons 1, which doesn't really make much sense. And the reader thinks, what is the first premise? But what is the first element in the list cons? There's no intuitive explanation. But if you write cons.ih, the reader says, oh, yeah, that's the induction hypothesis you're now using. And if you write cons.prems, the reader thinks, oh, yes, you're proving the implication. This is the left-hand side of the implication that you're now using. So, no questions, then we go back to the slide and just look at the same situation with the more complicated situation where you have, you're trying to show something which is an implication with some assumption and some conclusion P, and then you can do the same thing. You can say, okay, I want to prove this by induction. Then you get the same skeletons, K0, K-successor, but what do these things stand for? That's not so interesting. We focus on this one. In the successor case, it stands for this little line here, stands for these four lines. You fix an N, you assume the induction hypothesis, namely that AN implies PN, and you assume the left-hand side of the thing that you need to prove, namely you want to prove that A of suck of N implies P of suck of N. So you're allowed to assume A of suck of N, and you have to prove P of suck of N. That's the case. And if you're doing such a proof by structural induction, then if you say KC, then you get two kinds of things. You get C.IH, that's the induction hypotheses. There may be multiple ones in the tree, then you'll get an induction hypothesis for both subtrees. And then there will be C.Prems, which will again be a list, namely the list of all the assumptions in the implicational statement you're trying to prove. And the case will just be the B. And if you don't want to use them separately, you can just write C, and then C is just the concatenation of this list of theorems, or this list of assumptions, and this list of assumptions. But luckily, some of that work is of writing these inductive proofs is also supported by the machine. So if you go back to the proof by induction and you go over the proof, then it again shows you the skeleton, and you can click on the skeleton and put it into your buffer. Right. That's not quite the end, I'm afraid. Yes, this is just a remark on style, but computation induction is the last thing I need to talk about. There's this simple-minded induction, structural induction on a data type, and there's this more complicated version where you do induction on the computation of a function, and this is what I want to show you, how that looks like in ESA. Because for the data type, it's very clear, each case has the name of the constructor. But what are the cases in case you have a recursive function definition? Well, there, these recursive function definitions are usually just sequences of equations. So you can see one at the bottom. Div 2 has three equations, div 2 of 0 is 0, div 2 of successor of 0 is 0, and div 2 of suck of n is div 2 of n plus 1. So if I now want to prove something, like, for example, this one, 2 times div n is less or equal n, it's better not to try and do this by induction on n, but induction on N, yes, but also a special induction principle, namely the induction principle that came out of the div2 definition. If you want to look at it in isolation, you can ask what, please, is div2.induct. That's a theorem. And then if you look at it, you see the induction schema. So this is what the theorem says. It says if you want to prove P of some arbitrary variable A, then you have to prove P of 0, you have to prove P of 1, and you have to show that P of N implies P of suck of N. So that mirrors exactly, in a way that we had already discussed, the recursion equations with two base cases and one recursive call. And we're now asking the system to use this proof principle here in this computation induction step, and as a result, as you can see down here, we get three subgoals, one for each equation of the div2 definition. And if you look at the format, it's like what we have seen, except the cases are just given numeric names, 1, 2, 3, for the first equation, the second equation, and the third equation. So that's the difference between induction on a data type, where you can use the names of the constructors of the data type, and induction on a computation, where each individual equation doesn't have a name, and so it's numbered. That's the only difference. Otherwise, it's still the same thing. The same conventions apply, the same naming conventions, except for one little difference. Here you have to watch out for this one. Here we're using the induction hypothesis for the third case, and we're putting double quotes around them. That is because if you write a number dot something, that's not a legal name. A number by itself is a legal name, but for some reason a number dot something is not a legal name, and so you have to put the double quotes around it, and then it works. So that's a little a complication that may trip you up occasionally. So remember, names that are numbers, you need double quotes around them if you want to index it like that. So there's one complication that, or one, not complication, there's one a trap that you need to avoid and or that you need to be aware of. Namely, if we look at the definition of SEP that you see here, then we're using a little trick in the definition. Namely, the second equation that you write down actually stands for two equations, namely the empty list and the singleton list. The first equation, don't worry what exactly the function does. It doesn't matter. We have seen it before, but that's not the point. The point is just the patterns on the left. And the first SEP equation says applies if the list that you're matching on has at least two elements. And therefore, that means the remaining equations apply only for shorter, namely one on zero element lists. And these two equations, if you look at, if you ask the system what is sep.simps, then the system in general will give you back the equations that you have typed in, but not always. Like here, it can't give you back the second equation. The second equation is not an equation. We went through that again. We went through that before. So what the system did, it made the equations non-overlapping. And if you look at the three equations, it has, if you look at sep.simps, it has actually turned it into three equations. And these are now mutually exclusive, and they don't overlap, meaning that. And now that means that when you do an induction over the SEP definition, you don't get two cases, as you may think, oh, there are two equations, and so I get two cases. But in fact, you get three cases, each of the three cases for the simplification rules that the system derived from your definition. And if you look at the proof by induction, this line here, with using the rule SEP-induct, so using the customized induction schema coming from SEP, if you now look at the proof outline, you see something unusual. You see you have a case 1, of course, for the first equation, but then you have 2 underscore 1 and 2 underscore 2. That's the system's way of saying, oh, there's an equation 2 in your original definition, and I had to split that up into two separate equations, and I called them 2 1 and 2 2. And so that's why these funny names come up. But because the system generates these outlines, you don't have to guess the names. The system shows you the names, and you can just use that outline. So that's the only thing you need to be aware of when you have these function definitions and induction on the function definitions, that this may lead to these funny names. And so, that's it. And sometimes, individual numbers are okay, but if you have names like 2 underscore num, 2 underscore 1, that's not a legal name. You have to put it into double quotes, then it becomes a legal name. So that's the only reason. Yep.
Question, can one refer to the cases in a more verbose way so that a reader can directly see which equation you're referring to?
No, the best, well, yes, you can, and by explicitly writing out the abbreviation, because this case thing is a rather large thing, it abbreviates something large, and, well, actually not that large, in this case. So you could just explicitly write down, right, I think you need to fix an A because you're in this case here, and then there's nothing to assume, and then you would write out this explicitly. But you, otherwise, there's only this implicit way of using these funny names or explicitly writing the full thing out. Yeah. So that's that. And this is just what I showed you on the... in the system, if you have a function defined by fun, and you do, and that was defined by any equations, then if you do induction and then some typically variables, st and whatever, and you say, please use the rule of the induction schema generated by f, then you get the cases 1 to n, and you then write case and then the number, and any variables that occur in that that particular case, and I generally recommend you use the template that the system generates for you. And there's this naming thing that you can't write i.ih, you have to put it in double quotes, and that if the defining equations for your f overlap, then Isabel instantiates them, and you may get funny names of this form. But you always, when you go into the case, you can, the system will show you, oh, this is what you can assume and this is what you have to show. So even if you don't completely follow what's going on this, by going into the proof text of the ESA template, it'll show you what you currently can assume and what you have to show. And this is really the end of the ESA introduction. So any last questions? In that case, I want to move on and close this one and start. Yeah, but the demo comes in a moment. This is where I want to go. And now we start with some actual algorithms, little algorithms at the beginning. We start with a venerable old topic, sorting. And let's first discuss in general what does it mean for a sorting algorithm to be correct. And for that, we have a definition of sorted. That's a function that takes a linearly ordered list. I mean, the elements are linearly ordered in the list. When is something sorted? When is the list sorted? Well, the empty list is always sorted. And if you have a list that starts with an X, well, then that list is sorted if the tail is sorted and if all the elements in the tail are greater or equal than the head of the list. So that's just a simple recursive definition of sortedness. So I don't think I'll have to say more about that. But that's our standard of how we define something to be sorted. And so what does it mean to be, if you have a sort function that takes one of these lists where the elements have a linear order on them and produces a new list, when is it a sorting function? Well, you would at least require that the output is sorted of the function. But is that enough? Or would you want more than that? Yep.
We want all the elements in the original list to be there in the sorter.
And the other way around, we don't want any new elements to occur. So we could say that the set of elements in the sorted list is the same as the set of elements in the original list. Is that exactly what you want, or not quite?
Length should be the same, so that they are not
Right, yes. No, that's not enough. That sounds clever for a moment, but it's not quite correct. So you could, if you also require the length, it's still not enough. Why not?
Yeah, one element appeared twice in the original list, there could be another element appearing twice in the new list.
Yes.
So we have to say that for each element it has to occur the same amount.
Yeah, you can't just, I told you with the length it's not enough. You could have the input 001 and the output 011. Then both of these are satisfied, but it's not what you would expect.
The length of the sets of both.
The length of the sets, I don't think I've heard that. You mean the cardinality of the sets? Yeah, but then that's you need to say that. So this is basically every element occurs as often in one as in the other list, and this is how we can write this more compactly. We use the term, we use the type of multisets. So this is a new type, which I will briefly introduce now. And here we're saying, if you take this list here, the output list of the sorting, and you take it as a multiset, which means the order is irrelevant, but the number of times an element occurs is still relevant, then these two multisets must be the same. So mset is a function that maps a list into a multiset. So it's a cousin of the set function, but it doesn't occur the multiplicity. It doesn't ignore the multiplicity of elements. If you have an element multiple times in a list, it'll also be a multiple times in the multiset. And so what's a multiset? It's simply a set with possibly repeated elements, and it's predefined. It's in a library, you can load it, and it comes with a number of standard operations, like this is the empty multiset with a hash in the middle, then you have an add multiset that takes an element and a multiset and adds it to the multiset, not add in the numeric sense, but puts it in there as well. And you have a kind of union on multisets, where you take two multisets and get back a multiset, and the union is like you add the number of times each element occurs in the two multisets, and then you get a new multiset. So I assume the idea of a multiset is intuitive enough that I don't need to spend more time on it. And you don't need to, apart from knowing what these functions exist, you don't really need to know more than about the multiset library, because either simplification or sledgehammer will find the suitable lemmas for you. Ah, yes, and then there are these two functions, mset that convert a list into a multiset, and setmset that converts a multiset into a set by just ignoring the multiplicity of elements and just interpreting the thing as a set. And these are all the functions that we need to know about, and their names are already very suggestive of what they are doing. So that's a brief intro to the multiset library, which is useful not just for sorting, we will need it again later on for priority queues. Questions about multisets? No, I didn't think so. So now let's move on to a real sorting algorithm, not a particularly difficult one, but we want to start out small. So insertion sort. And let's first prove the correctness of insertion sort, and that won't take much time. That is pretty straightforward and doesn't even need ESA. So
you were in the right. In the folder before there was like this THYS folder, which was referenced on the slide.
Yes, but I want to show you a different version of it, which I've moved out of there. So you will find the full version in the library, in the Bitbucket repository, and what I'll show you is the version where I've removed some proofs because I wanted to go through them with you. I mean, I will to discover them with you. But otherwise, it's just what you'll see here is a trimmed down version of what is also in the library, in the Bitbucket
repository. And up here, you see I'm importing the multiset library. And I'm also starting from complex main, but that's only in a very last lemma where I suddenly turn to real numbers. You can ignore that. And here in the first line, I'm hiding some predefined sorted and insertion sort predicates on lists that are a bit more complicated than what I need, and therefore I'm defining the more simplistic version that we see here. And we prove a little lemma that the sort append, if you want to know whether an append of two lists is sorted, well, the two sublists have to be sorted, sorted X's and sorted Y's, and then all the elements of the first list must be less or equal than the elements of the second list. So you see this sorted predicate works with the set function that turns lists into sets. And we'll have to therefore prove lemmas about this set function. And these are the two functions needed to define insertion sort. So this is insort, that is the auxiliary function, and it simply takes a list and an element and inserts the element at the right place in the list. Sorry, the first argument here, that's the element, and then it takes a list and produces a list, and it inserts the element in the right place in the list according to the order. So this is, if it's the empty list, then of course it's just a singleton list what you get back. And if it's a cons that you're trying to insert into, then you have to check, is the element X that you're inserting, is that less or equal than the head of the list? And then you can just put it there before the head of the list, and otherwise you recurse and put it into the tail of the list. So not very demanding. And then the insertion sort algorithm takes a list where the elements are linearly ordered and gives you back a list. And if it's empty, then of course you get back the empty list. And if it starts with an element X, then you recursively sort. So isort is the top-level function, insort is the one further down. So you first recursively sort the tail of the list, and then you insert the first element in the right place in the list. So extremely simple a programming exercise. So now we want to prove. So any questions about this? I hope not. Good. So now we want to prove functional correctness. And we do this in a straightforward manner, and I'm not going to go through the proofs in detail. Here are the first we show that the multiset of the input and the output is the same. And you have to do that in two steps. First, you show it for the insort algorithm. So if you take the multiset that comes out of the insort algorithm with an element X and X's, then that's the same as adding the element X to the multiset of X's. And it's just an induction on the list X's, and everything goes through automatically. And then for the insort, for the isort, the insertion sort algorithm, which relies on insort, you can prove the same property here. It's just even simpler. The multiset that comes out of insertion sort is the same is the same as the multiset that went into insertion sort, and you do an induction on the list. And in the second case, in the non-empty list case, in the cons case, there you need this lemma that we just proved, how the multiset function behaves on insort. Yeah. So I think that even without looking at the proofs, that makes globally sense. And if you look at the functions, it's also pretty obvious that you don't lose any elements and you don't generate any elements, so it would be strange if that was difficult to prove. And now we prove in a second step that the function, that the list of the, well, we have two functions. We have the insort function and we have the insertion sort, the isort function. And we start out with the property, if you insert an element A into the list X's, then the result is sorted. And you could, I mean, naturally, you might be tempted to say, oh, if X is sorted initially, then insort of AX is sorted afterwards. But in fact, it's an equivalence, and it's usually, if you can get an equivalence, it's nicer than an implication. And so we prove the implication that the sortedness of the insort result is the same as the sortedness of the argument of the insort. And this proof didn't quite go through, so let's look at what's missing. So this is what we're left with. So this is, you see now what we're trying to prove. Oops. This sorted of insort is like sorted is equal to sorted of X's. And here you now see down there the sub-goal, which looks kind of complicated, and the system couldn't prove it automatically. So if you look at that sub-goal, do you think there's anything in there that we should simplify? And that the system didn't manage to simplify. What would you expect this to be? Yeah?
A added to the set of X's?
Yes. So you're, and if you have that lemma, then actually the proof will go through. But so at the moment, the system doesn't know anything about what the set of elements is that come out of insort. What I suggest is to prove this, and that's exactly the line below, and that's the line you suggested. I'm using the function insert. There's an insert function on sets that takes an element and a set and inserts the element into the set. And this is what I'm using to write down that line. Now, how should we prove that? And there are actually two ways of doing it. Come on, there's a standard way of doing this. So, yeah. You? Yes, exactly. And that works, but that's in some sense too complicated. There's a simpler way.
Yeah, we can use the, we can convert the M set to set.
Right, because we know already that the same thing is true for the multisets. So surely there should be a simple way of getting from the multiset statement that we have up here. Here is the multiset version of it. Surely the set version should be easy to derive, and indeed this is what this Metis call does. It uses a couple of lemmas, and you see, for example, there's a lemma called set M set M set. So something that tells you this lemma is probably about conversion between sets and M sets. And it also uses the some lemmas that we have proved, like the set M set at M set M. No, I'm not quite sure what this one is. I don't want to look at them, but this was found by Sledgehammer. It could just combine what was already there and prove that. And then you can continue like that, and eventually you can also prove the sortedness of, here it is, here's the main theorem, sorted of insertion sort of X's. So the functional correctness is not very difficult once you've understood what multisets are, and the algorithm is so simple that just induction on X's will do things, and you don't even need the ESA language to set up a more complicated induction schema. But now I want to move on to something more interesting, namely time complexity. And we'll do it not with the slides first, because the slides give a very general approach to it. We'll just do it quite concretely on this example. And our approach to time complexity in this course will be that we simply count function calls. And we only count function calls of the interesting functions. So those functions that recurs down the list and recurs down the tree and that really take time, in particular because trees and lists are dynamic data structures that are distributed over the storage, and therefore access to those data structures really costs time. Whereas adding two numbers, forget it. We don't count that. So basically, things on Booleans and things on numbers, we take for granted. You can take time one or time zero even. Because although we will not work with O of n, we will not really care about the exact value of the constants. We just avoid the O of notation because it introduces more mathematical overhead, and we want to have the overhead as simple as possible. But on the other hand, we morally work with O of in the sense that we ignore everything that is that can be ignored, and we boil down all the constants to one or zero, whatever is appropriate. So in the example that we want to now tackle is the time complexity of insertion sort, and the principle that we use here is we simply count the number of recursive calls, which means the base case is already at zero, which, as usual with natural numbers, makes everything simpler. And so we have here, I've just copied the function definition. So these are just the two lines of the function definition. And down here, I have defined a function T underscore. This will always be our naming convention if we define a function that computes the time complexity of something, then it'll just be that same function name, but with a T underscore in front of it. So T insort means it's the time complexity of function insort. It takes the same parameters as function insort, but it gives back a natural number, namely how many recursive calls were made. And so if you look at the first line for insort, where you insert an element into the empty list, well, that's just in no time, basically. You don't have any recursive calls. So you say, okay, if the argument list is empty, then the result is simply zero. There are no recursive calls. If, on the other hand, we're in this situation, then, of course, there can be recursive calls. So you have the same skeleton of a function. Down here, you have again a test for if x is less than or equal y, but then you look up there, you say, oh, if x is less than or equal y, you have the result, no more recursion, and so you just say zero. If, on the other hand, you have this recursive call of insort, then you take the time of insort, oh, and plus one. Should the plus one... yes, okay. I think strictly speaking, the plus one should be inside the else. I've overestimated it a little by pulling it out, but that's okay. It may have just either I made a mistake or I intentionally simplified it so it made one of the proofs simpler. It still will be an over approximation, and we're only interested in upper bounds, and so that's okay.
Yeah, also in this case, every operation costs at least one.
Yeah, but then it should have been one in the base case as well.
Yeah, but when you call it, then it adds one. Because you do the recursive call.
Well,
on the empty list and then an empty one. So also the empty list case also takes time.
Sorry, you're saying here it should be with something else or?
No.
But you see, I think if I take this literally here, we count the number of recursive calls, then it should have been like this. This, I think, is the right translation of the we count the number of recursive calls. Because in the then case, there are no recursive calls, and therefore it should be zero. The then case is like the base case. Does that make sense? Or?
Yeah.
Yeah, and so...
Because if you think of O notation, like there is nothing which causes... Zero.
Right. Strictly speaking, we should start at one, And then we can renormalize and say, well, it doesn't, with respect to O, it doesn't matter if you start at 0 or 1. So I'm doing a lot of massaging here in my head and justifying it implicitly with saying, oh, as long as it's the same big O, we're okay. So this is not very formal. At this point, we're allowing ourselves to be informal in writing down these timing functions. And I will give a precise definition of how to, a precise formal definition, but after that formal definition, you can, then there are some heuristics how to simplify it, and I've applied these heuristics. But let's stick with this version. This version is certainly an over-approximation, so it's certainly okay. And you could even have a 1 here, but I think then one of my proofs breaks down, and so that's why we don't do that. And for insertion sort, it's for the top-level function, it's a bit more lengthier. We have this, so this is I sort of the empty list is the empty list, so time for I sort of the empty list is 0, no recursive calls, and here we have to count two things, because on the right-hand side we have two calls. We have a call of insort and we have a call of isort, so we need to count the time. We need to add together the time. And so this is what we have here. It's the time for isort of x's, and it's the time for insort, but now a called with isort of x's. So this is this bit here. Corresponds to this inner call here. No, sorry, corresponds to this outer call here. Right, it corresponds to the outer call. It's the time that insort takes on the list that comes out of isort. And then you have the plus 1, because now you're in the recursive case. You have one recursive call. Yeah?
Is there a T function for all the library
methods? No, there isn't. You have to do that. We probably provide that in, if we have exercises, we'll probably provide those. And in fact, since this is all a bit informal, most of the time we will provide those functions. And or if we ask you to provide them, we won't be terribly upset if you put a 1 in a place where there should be a 0 or the other way around. Of course, there are limits. If I drop this plus 1 here, for example, then it just definitely is wrong, because then everything is just 0. So you have to be a bit intelligent about these setting up these functions. So let's this one really models exactly this idea of counting recursive functions, and we could have started with 1, then it would have counted all the function calls, which is, I think, then in some of the proofs, some of the some of the terms become a bit more complicated. So I've tried to simplify the proofs. So, any last questions about these timing functions? And we will go into through the details of the theoretical justification next time. Yeah?
I have a question. How do we know that timing function really measures the time of our function?
Well, are you saying the machine model might be very different, or the machine might... Oh, okay. Then I will give a precise way of deriving the time function, where I would actually, according to this precise way of doing things, I would get a 1 here. And then there are heuristics that say, oh, in the base case here, it's okay to use a 0 rather than a 1 because of O notation. So at least the definition of the standard timing functions, the non-optimized ones, that's mechanical. And it's mechanical according to rules that I give you on the slides.
But we still define them ourselves. So.
You mean you can make a typo?
Yeah, no, I don't. I mean, we write something down, but in principle, the T insert, for example, has nothing to do with insert.
No. So you can make terrible mistakes here, and so that's where the informality creeps in. But we're no worse than any algorithms course here.
Yeah.
So what you can do, but we haven't done that, you could write a little piece of ML code, add it to the system that automatically generates T insort from insort. So then at least there would be the only mistake that the person who wrote that piece of code, that person could have made a mistake, but you can no longer make the mistake. So it's just one down to you're focusing on one piece of trusted code that you now have to check, but not you don't have to you can't make a mistake every time. But let's take that. We can discuss that again next week when I'm coming back. When we look at the slides, there is a little bit of discussion on that. But there is some informality here, no doubt. So now let's use this and let's prove that the time for insertion sort, for I sort, is bounded by the length of the list to squared. And I want to fix on, so this is the thing I want to prove, and then we're done today. And so we might go a little bit over time, but not much. So it's by induction on axis, and so we have the nil case, that's trivial, and then we have the cons case. And so I want to write this proof. I don't think it goes through automatically. We should be writing it as a sequence of equations and inequations. And I've started out with the time for the inductive step. You're now sorting a list that's one longer, namely x cons x's. So now, with your help, we will complete that proof. And so in the end, we can then finally show case with dot. So hopefully out of the system or the sequence of inequations that we prove beforehand, we can then get our final result. So this zero, of course, is rubbish. I just wanted something that type checks. So first suggestion, what do we do in the first step? Well, I'll give you a hint. We simply use the function definition. What is T in TI sort of this thing? And write that down. And we can just copy that from the definition a bit further up. And so we just have a trivial step here where we have simply expanded the function definition. Let me make it one smaller. Yeah. Is that still readable? Okay, then it's because the terms are longer. And so how is that proved? Of course, just by simp, because that's just the definition of the function. But now we have to be a bit more intelligent. And I don't know whether it's equal or less than equal. You have to tell me what I should be doing now. So we have these three terms here. That's the time for the sorting, the recursive sorting of the tail of the list, and that's the time of adding in that element. Yeah?
Yeah, we can use the induction hypothesis.
Yep, exactly, to give an upper bound for this one.
Yeah.
Yes. So we write a less than or equal, and then it'll be, well, I assume length of x is squared. And then we just keep those other two things and add them to it. So since I don't think you should use it as a simp rule, I think you should just say using what?
Const.ih.
Const.ih. And now if we go on to the output window, you can actually see what this const.ih is, and then it says, oh yes, using this one, that the time for I sort of x is less than length of x squared, and that's exactly what we want here, because we have replaced in our equation chain this by this. And so now, in fact, we can, to check our intuition, we can just say by arith, because that should just be an arithmetic property. And indeed, yes, there's that's just the consequence of arithmetic. So what do we do now? Of course, we have to look at this thing here. So can somebody give an informal argument how we can get an upper bound for this term? Yes?
Yeah, so we potentially go through the whole list of this length of x's.
Yes. Okay, so that's the length of x's. But for that, you need to know something about isort, because your insort, isort has a certain property when it comes to the lists that it produces. Yeah?
The length is the same.
The length is the same, yep. And so down here, so we didn't see it already, but I can now go and copy it. Here is that the first lemma is that the time of for insort of some element is bounded by the length of the list. That was the first argument. And then the second argument is that the length of isort is just the length of x's plus 1. So I think the length of insort. So I'm not going to go through the exact formulation of the lemmas. They are just induct auto proofs, and we put them in here. Oops. So that was the estimate for the inserting operation. That's bounded by the length of the list. And here we know that the length of insort is the length of x's plus 1. And here we have the length of isort is just the length of the input list. And I think this is the one we will need. Or in fact, I think we will need both of them. So let's use this one and probably also this one. In fact, we simplify matters. We make this a simp thing, so it'll be applied automatically. So now what we want is this one plus, what was it?
Length x's
plus 1, of course. The plus 1 stays there. And now we say again, that's not what I wanted. I wanted this name here. This is the estimate, the upper bound for the T insort. And, of course, we need that upper bound to go from here to here. So we use it. But now we have to give a bit more information because if you look at what you're using has these completely uninstantiated unknowns in it, x and x's, question mark x and question mark x's. And the arithmetic tactic or the simplifier it won't be able to use this. Using blah, blah, blah by simp. And it won't work. It'll complain. It'll say, failed to finish the proof. And it'll show you that somehow it didn't. Why couldn't it prove that? That's a bit funny. Actually, I would have expected it to do that.
Did you mark the right moves?
I mean, I marked this that the length of isort is the same as the length of the input. But this here should imply this here. It should find the right instantiation. Anyway, it doesn't for some reason that I can't figure out at the moment. So what you do is you give it the right instantiation. So you say, I want this lemma, and I instantiate it as follows. If this is the uninstantiated lemma, and so for this x, we want our x here, and for this question mark x's, we want our x's here. And so you just say of x and x's. There's some more general problem going on here.
Maybe there's a plus one missing.
But you see what's left over. Let's just do apply synth, then it's better. This is left over. Oh. I gave the wrong instantiation. Yes. Yes. And now, yes, no subgoals. So, this makes a lot more sense now, this left-hand side, because that also appears here in what we're trying to prove. So we had to instantiate that, and for some reason, which I, at the moment, a bit puzzled about, the simplifier didn't find that. And so this is not too unusual that you may need to instantiate a lemma with specific values of your proof, and then the proof goes through, whereas if you just leave them unspecified, then the automation doesn't find the right values. And right now, we're almost done. So from here to here, it's not that far. So here, the length of that, because the length of this one, of course, is just the length of x's plus 1. And if you square that, then you get length of x's squared plus 2 times length of plus 2, right? Isn't that? Yes, I think this is the, I think from here to here that's a lesser or equal, that should be provable by what mechanism? Arith doesn't know about multiplication, so it doesn't know about exponentiation or squaring. But if you get rid of the squaring, so if you replace the square by a multiplication and then also multiply things out, then I think it will do it. So we can just try this. We can just say apply simp, and then we'll see what happens. So apply simp, yeah. You can see what's left over. There's still this, That's already pretty good, I think. Yes, except for the square. Yes, you need to get rid of the square. So, because you need to multiply things out in order to find that this side is really bigger than this side. So we can use the usual one. What was it? Numeral EQ suck, I think it is. Numeral EQ suck. Or you can use something else. You can also ask query, isn't there a theorem of the form something to the square equals something times something? And it'll say, yes, there is something called like that, and it's called power EQ square. And so let's try that one. Simp add power EQ square, that's more. And then it actually came out. So it was just a question of multiplying things out. And then if you make that into a by, then everything falls into place. And I'm afraid it can be quite tricky to find the right lemmas and to maybe instantiate the lemmas correctly so that this equation chain goes through. But for your exercises, at the very least, produce these equation chains and try and prove as many of them as you can. And if you get stuck somewhere and it takes too much time, you can leave a sorry in and we'll just deduct a little bit. So now we've really gone over time. Sorry about that. But I think we've now got to a place that has prepared you for the exercise sheet, and you'll now be able to deal with that. Any last questions about what we've seen today or this particular proof? Right. In that case, enjoy the Pentecost holiday, and I'll see you again on Friday, I hope, in a week.
Ja.
Weil ich habe mir mal so ein bisschen den Beweis angeschaut für den Lifecycle-Rhythmus bei dem Archive von Formel 1.
Ja.
Und mich hat immer interessiert, weil ich habe nicht ganz verstanden, wie man, also dieser Pseudocode, von beiden Konzepten, also Pseudocode, und wie man den überhaupt, also.
Da sollten wir so genau angucken, was Sie da meinen. Das wollen wir natürlich hier Schluss machen mal. Naja.